Singer-songwriter David Starr joins the program now. Welcome, David.
Hi, thanks for calling.
So are you surviving the pandemic in style, sir?
In style, well, I am. Like I mentioned before we came on the air, my guitar store here on Main Street in Cedar Edge, we closed up for a few weeks as per the governor's wishes, and that was probably wise. But we've reopened slowly, and things seem to be going okay. I miss traveling, but here we are, you know.
Well, speaking of traveling, right about now you would have been in England, is that right?
I would have been in North Wales last night, playing about my third or fourth gig of that tour. That would have been my sixth tour over there.
Wow.
And instead of playing the gig that I would have played last night, I did an online gig for the very same group. And we had planned to do the little side note, the lady whose home I was going to play in, she has a little venue in her home. She works with refugees on a Greek island, and people who are fleeing persecution, that sort of thing. She helps them and is part of that group. And so we were going to do a benefit for them while I was there, but instead we just did an online benefit and ended up raising quite a bit of money for them. So it worked out okay.
Well, I looked at your Facebook page before I called you this morning, and I guess that was last night that you did that. Is that right?
Well, it was noon yesterday my time, but it would have been 7 o'clock over there. So, yeah, it worked out. It was fine. I got to do my gig, and I was done by 1:30 in the afternoon. I like those hours.
Yeah, those are good hours for sure. Well, you're maintaining a pretty active presence online during this time, I noticed on your Facebook page. Are you still doing your Tuesday night thing? Tell me a little about that.
Yeah. Thank you for asking. Tomorrow night will be Tuesday, I guess that will be, what, the 19th? Is that right?
Yep.
The Tuesday night deal, what I came up with was the project that I was out touring and had just released when all this shutdown business happened, is an album called Beauty and Ruin that I worked on over the last couple of years with John Oates and a lot of great folks down in Nashville. That album was based on a book my grandfather wrote and published in 1972, the year before he died. And the songs are all based on the songwriters who were involved. A number of songwriters helped me on it. And everybody took pieces and parts of the book and wrote songs based on their inspiration from the book. So what I've been doing on Tuesday nights, this will be my third or fourth one, I guess, is talking about a particular song, focusing on one song, then reading the part from the book where we got our inspiration, and maybe also talking about the artist and songwriters involved in that particular song. So just a little 30-minute try to get people interested in the book. So far, it's been a lot of it.
Well, let's talk about Beauty and Ruin. From the outside looking in, David, this seems like a masterwork to me. It feels like it's a real artistic statement. It's very personal. It's kind of elegiac in tone, I would say. Does it feel that way to you? You've been living with it now for a while. How does the album feel to you?
Very kind to say all of that, and I appreciate it.
Well, this album, Beauty and Ruin, it was produced by John Oates, and you've been buddies with John for a while. What did John bring to the project as a producer?
John's got a great, you know, history with making hit records to start with. So the way he and I've sort of developed our relationship as it relates to songwriting and him producing me, this is our second project together. He's able to take what is essentially a pretty simple song that I put together, and he just takes it to the next level. He puts his producer's ear on it, and he's a little more dispassionate about the song and can say, well, what if we move this over here and change this one or two little things? Melodically, he's got a great sense of melody. And as I've told a lot of people and I've talked to him about, he's got a chord vocabulary on the guitar that is really, really extraordinary. Because, and I asked him about it. I said, you make some sort of interesting chord shapes in your your chord inversions are different than a lot of the ones I've seen. And he said it has to do with having played with Daryl Hall all these years, because Daryl's a great keyboard player and a great piano and songwriter. And John had to sort of find, along the way, had to find ways to make his chord structures work with those piano chords, which is not as easy as it sounds. So he brings that sensibility, and he just has an ear for a hook, you know, and how to take a song that's a pretty much a little singer-songwriter folk song and say, how do we make that so that it has a longer life and is a little more interesting to the listener right off the bat? So I can't even begin to tell you what he brought to it, but it wouldn't have gotten done without him.
You mentioned earlier that you approached a lot of musicians to co-write on these songs. How did that co-write process work? Was it you writing lyrics and then your co-writer bringing in the melodies? How did it work?
Well, let's start with John Oates. John and I think we ended up co-writing four or five of the songs on the record. On the bulk of those songs, I had written a song and was not really through with it, not really finished, and it wasn't fully formed, and then John helped me finish it. So in that respect, he like I said earlier, brought it to the next level. There was a song called The Road to Jubilee that was John's idea initially, and he and I worked on it together. Then we sort of let it stew for a little bit while he was touring and I was touring. Then we came back and brought Jim Lauderdale, a Nashville legend. We brought him into the mix, and we all sat for an entire day and just bounced ideas around. And then John took it, kind of pulled it all together with those ideas. In the case of the other songwriters, Dana Cooper, Wood Newton, Irene Kelly, my friend Shelley Ray, who worked here with me at the store, and the Wild Ponies, Doug and Talisha Williams, in all those cases, I just gave them the book and said, what is it that inspires you? Each one of them came back and said, here's the title, or here's the idea, or here's the melody. Let's sit down and write a song. And that's what happened in almost all those cases. In the case of Doug and Talisha, they came to me with a song that was fully formed, and I didn't have to do a thing. So that's the only one that I'm not a part of on the record, and that's just fine. It's a beautiful song. It's called Bury the Young. And so everybody sort of arrived at it with their own sense of what they wanted to do, and then we just went from there.
So they read the book first?
Yeah. Yeah, that was the idea. It was, read this book, and you come back and tell me. You know, a good example is Irene Kelly, who's a great country writer but a really good bluegrass writer, came back and said, this reminds me of Wuthering Heights. And So we took a tragic The role of grief is fairly prominent in this book, so in a couple of occasions, that's what we focused on. Dana Cooper and I, he had been out on the road like he is a lot, and he posted a picture to Facebook, and the caption he wrote was, there's so much beauty and ruin out here. And I immediately texted him, and I said, that's our title right there.
Yes, it
so
is.
We took that.
Yeah.
And so everything, I don't know, it's just, there's a, I was telling John, there's a lot of happy accidents when you're putting this kind of thing together, but I couldn't be more happy with it. And, you know, we reprinted the book, and which is sort of an homage to my grandfather. And my only regret is he isn't here for me to tell him about this and to talk to him about the book, because I don't know how much of it really happened and how much of it was, you know, a product of his imagination. But it's a cool project, and I'm really proud of it.
So maybe give us a little synopsis of the story. Is it a coming-of-age story? Is it what's it about?
Well, a little bit. Let's in a nutshell, a family moves from Ohio to the sandy soil, as my grandfather says, of southwest Arkansas after the Civil War. They inherit 40 acres, kind of the old 40 acres and a mule thing. They wind up with this land, and this young kid named Frank, he's probably 14 or 15, let's say, he ends up going down the dirt road in the county to work for a guy named Captain. And Captain's a bigger-than-life hero of the Spanish-American War, and he's a cattle guy. And so this young man goes to work for him, and they have a pretty good arrangement. And then one day, Captain comes home and says, I'm going to get married. I've found me a bride. And so this woman named Laura comes to live with him as the captain's husband, as captain's wife, and she essentially brings a certain amount of chaos into the situation because she wants a bunch of kids, and the captain's unable to give her children for medical reasons, and so she goes off and finds herself someone who can help her with that, if you get my drift. And so a child is brought into the household, and there's just a lot of deceit, denial, chaos, and ultimately tragedy that befalls these families.
Oops. Are you there?
I think in my grandparents' life, they had a couple of children who didn't live to be more than a year old, as happened back in the early days. And so all those themes are woven into the story. But at the very end, Frank and one other gal are look to the future and see where it might go. And in some ways, I feel like my grandfather might have had another book in him, you know, about these two people. But there's death, there's adultery, there's out of wedlock children, there's all the stuff in there that you think your grandparents don't know anything about. but lo and behold, they know stuff, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's not a happy story, but the very last page or two, you start to think maybe there's hope, you know. But I love the book.
Did you do you remember reading it as I guess you were a kid when that was published?
I didn't read it, and I really regret that. I didn't read it until about 8 years ago, and that's on me. I should have, but for whatever reason, I didn't. And then as soon as I did, I went and bought all of them I could find on Amazon. And best I can tell, there weren't a lot of them distributed because he would sell his books much the way a singer-songwriter does now with CDs. We'd sell them at the gig, you know, and he'd go to craft fairs, and he'd go to a garden club or a public library or a rummage sale or whatever, set up a card table and sell them and sign them, you know. And so a lot of them just sat on shelves or just sat in boxes and never got distributed. So the fact that we were able to reprint the book and obtain the copyright and all that's pretty cool.
Yeah, you brought new life to something. I wonder if you've ever, did you receive any kind of, affirmation from him or from the universe that, you know, this was a great thing that you did, bringing this story back to light?
Well, yeah, as a matter of fact, about halfway through this project, two-thirds way through the project, I became very ill with an intestinal problem and had to have emergency surgery. And while I was in the hospital, I had a pretty vivid dream, and my grandfather and my deceased father were in it. And it was kind of terrifying, but at the same time, reassuring. And what I took out of that dream was that it wasn't my time yet, and I was going to get through this surgery okay. And that's the song Rise Up Again came out of that dream. So some songs sort of found their way into the project, and that's one of them. It didn't come directly from the book, but there were it was a product of the of him and of the book, I guess, in a way, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like he was on board, even though he's gone.
Well, you know, the model in the music industry with surrounding a new release, of course, is touring after releasing it. And obviously that's been impossible for you. What are your plans for the CD going down the road?
Well, I've been doing a lot of this, you know, this online stuff, and people seem to respond to that. I mailed out four, you know, I did that one yesterday. I mailed out four or five CD and book packages to people in the UK, you know, so just this morning. So they're just from that little deal yesterday, there are people who are interested in it and who want to experience it. I think going forward, we're just going to have to relook at what touring looks like. I do a lot of house concerts and a lot of listening rooms, so I don't play bars anymore, and I don't play rooms where there's lots of commotion and noise. And I think if we can get to a point where we're back to being with people that we know, that we have some kind of social relationship with, that we sort of have a level of trust with in terms of spending an evening in an enclosed space or doing more outdoor shows.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how that looks, but I really look forward to the time we can get back in front of people, because I miss that. I really do.
Well, it strikes me that the album has legs. It's gonna, you know.
I hope so.
There's enough in it to engage people, you know. So it's just a matter of how are people gonna find it, I guess.
Yeah, well, and you know, I just keep directing them to my website and hoping that that they'll go there and have a look and a listen and maybe order up the book. And you know, I've got a guy kind of working on a guy out in L.A. working on an audiobook version of it. We'll hopefully get the book in some bookstores as time goes on. The timing for all of us was bad with this pandemic, but at least we got it released. And I feel really bad for people who had a release date of, I don't know, March 15th, yeah, as opposed to February 15th, because yeah, it's easy for things to get buried in all this. And at least I got it out there. So it's kind of on me to keep the flame burning, I guess.
Well, according to your website, which, by the way, is davidstarrmusic.com, that's two R's, star.
Thank you.
You have a couple of gigs lined up coming up here, one in Paonia at the Loft. Is that Louis Pizza?
That is, Louis Loft. And I don't know if we're going to do that or not. I've got to get a hold of those folks and see where we stand on it. And that was originally scheduled for April, and we moved it out to June thinking this thing would settle down. And to some extent it has, but I'm of the mind that we ought to be more careful than not. I just feel like it's serious business and we ought to be careful.
Yeah.
And that's the way I'm handling it.
And I see too that you were or are scheduled for the High Mountain Bluegrass Festival over there in Westcliff, and that's usually in June, so I guess they postponed that until September, is that right?
That was already going to be in September. For whatever reason, they moved that.
Oh.
When I booked it, we had booked it for September. So, I guess they had just decided to change that before all this happened. So I hope that's still on. Maybe by then things will have eased up a little bit. And, I love Westcliff. I love that area. I drive through there a lot on the way to see folks in Arkansas when I go home to visit. And, beautiful spot.
Yes, it is. No doubt about it. And then you're also scheduled for Applefest in Cedar Ridge, which I hear really great things about.
It's, you know, we have, when I came here about 20 years ago, it was a good little festival, but the music part of it was just kind of coming on, and some people asked me if I'd like to help with that, and I was happy to do it. And over the years, I've tried to bring in, you know, we don't have a big budget because it's a free festival, but I try to bring in local acts and some regional acts and people who are in the area passing through. And we have a lot of fun, but in a good year, we'll have 23,000 people at that thing,
yeah,
over the weekend. I don't know where we stand with it this year. You know, it's
right.
It's just hard to know how to plan that stuff. And we have, I think the chamber has decided to wait till the 1st of July to make it a definitive call on that once we see kind of where we are, but we haven't written it off. We're just going on wait and see posture.
You know, doing my research before I talked to you, David, I discovered something that I didn't know. You're involved with the founding of the Grand Mesa Arts Center.
Uh-huh.
Tell me about that. That's really cool to know that that's there.
Well, for a number of years, well, ever since I came here, I've produced concerts on occasion. And the very first concert I did was down the street at the Apple Shed. John McEwen and I have been friends for a long time, John from the Dirt Band, and he called after I moved here and said, let's do a show out there where you live now. So we did that, and I've had a lot of people here. Oates has played, Dana Cooper, Tom Kimmel, Michael Lilly, our old friend Bobby Mason from the Roaring Fork Valley has been over here a lot. Countless other people over the years. And my wife, Cindy, had said to me a few years ago, we ought to have a dedicated place in town where we can have the arts, and that not just performing arts, but visual arts and classes and that sort of thing. So in 2017, a group of us got together and sort of brainstormed this thing, and there's a building sort of catty-cornered to my store here that was empty at that moment, and we went into negotiations to lease that and remodel it. So we've got, long story short, half the building is set up as a gallery space where we can have We rotate local artists in and out about every 8 weeks. And then there's their teaching space in there. There's a nice green room and some office space and a small kitchen. Then the other half of the building is what I would basically call a black box theater. It can be used for a lot of things, but it's got a 12 by 27 foot stage with full lights and sound. And then you can seat about 170 people in folding chairs in there. So, you know, in the last year we've done bluegrass. We've Carla Bonoff played again for the second time in 2 years. Oates and I did a show, a couple of shows in there a year and a half ago, two in one day. We sold out two shows. So local folks, regional artists, Ronnie Cox was there, our good friend Dana Cooper again. So we've had to shut that down in the interim, but people have been great about stepping forward and saying we'll keep our memberships going, we'll keep donating, and we've got a lot of good things coming up. We've tried to do some online things for kids, so it's not just any one thing, but it's a place where the arts, it's a hub for the arts, I guess, would be a good way to put it.
And that's a really great model that's proven successful all over the state in rural areas.
Yeah, we set it up as a nonprofit, so people can make donations, and we try to keep our expenses down and deliver good content to folks, and they seem to really enjoy it.
Lastly, David, before I let you go, back in the day, I'm talking back in the 80s, I seem to vaguely remember seeing a band called the David Starr Band play in Aspen. Now, I don't remember exactly where it was. It might have been Patty Bugatti's or some. Did you play back then in Aspen?
Hey, I may not remember where it was either, but yes. I moved to Aspen in July 1st of 81 and was there until July of 85. And when I originally got there, the first gig I got was being Bobby Mason's drummer because he had moved back from Florida, huh. I think, is where he was. And so I played, and then Bobby moved away again and went someplace. And I put a band together with the remnants of that band and called it the David Starr Band. So, yeah, I played at Bugatti's. We played at the Paragon. We played at the... what was it? The Slope there on the mall. Played lots of weddings, and then I also worked 5 days a week at Colorado Mountain College, the Aspen. So, I was pretty active in Aspen for those 4 years, and didn't sleep much, didn't get much rest, but I sure had a great time and met a lot of people who to this day I have strong friendships with. So, that was me.
Huh. Now, is that how you met John Oates? Is during that time in Aspen?
No, because I think John and I kind of, he may have gotten there about the time I was leaving or shortly thereafter. I met John through the guys that he played with over there in Little Blue, Michael Jude and John Michelle and those guys.
Yeah.
And they had, and I met John in Sandy Monroe's store one day several years ago, and I remember that. I'm not sure John does because it was just in passing. But then about 10, 11 years ago, Michael Jude said, "Let's get John over there to where you live and have him play." And so they talked John into me being the guitar player that night, and the rest is history. So John's been great to work with, and those guys are good friends to this day.